intact, and you had at least some of the plasma membrane or the axolemma that's still intact, the amenorrhea that's still intact, and then some regeneration sometimes can occur. This is showing a nerve that's very normal, very happy. Here's the soma. Here's amenorrhea, myelin sheath, blah, blah, blah. Schwann cells, muscle fibers, neuromuscular junction, and everybody is happy. You get some kind of trauma that damages or severs the nerve at this point. So first thing, you know, macrophages are going to show up. Macrophages always show up. They show up to clean up potential hazards, whether you're talking about infection or whether you're talking about damage or dead tissue. Macrophages show up. And the terminals, after this trauma occurs, begin to degenerate. Okay, the neuromuscular junctions, anyway. So the fibers injured. Degeneration of severed fiber, anyway, everything in here, this the axon that's on the inside is going to degenerate. Okay, you still have the outside that's present. You've got the amenorrhea and the myelin sheath that's still present, and the process will begin to occur. One of the things that happens is you get these nerve growth factors, which I think your book mentions anyway. That's important in the process. The regeneration will start. You begin to grow the axon. The Schwann cells will stay intact. The nerve growth factors and the proteins kind of interesting. What the nerve growth factor does is it prevents apoptosis. Anybody take 1-9? You remember what apoptosis is? What's apoptosis, Sharif?
Death of a cell.
What?
Remember.
What's apoptosis?
Program death of a cell.
The what? Program death of a cell, absolutely. Okay, and it happens whenever cell wears out, when its programming says it's time to die, the lysosomes pretty much all release all these hydrolytic enzymes and it eats itself up. So it commits suicide. The lysosomes, anyway, in some cases called suicide sacs, those are fun. So regeneration begins, the Schwann cells stay in place, and the axon will continue to extend. Eventually, the neuromuscular junction will repair. Another thing that happens during this process, once you cut off innervation to the muscles, they will begin to atrophy. So they, because of no activity, when you lose the nerve, essentially innervating that nerve, that muscle tissue, the muscle tissue is going to stop contracting. Stop contracting, you will begin to atrophy or get smaller. One of the things that happens once the regeneration is complete, neuromuscular junction is present, is that then the muscle fibers will begin to hypertrophy, or they will begin to come back to normal so that you can reestablish that, that connection. Does it happen all the time? But it can happen. Depending upon how severe the damage is and what's going on. We're interested in electrophysiology, which is essentially the conduction of the muscle of a nerve stimulus. Electrophysiology is the term for the cell mechanisms that produce electrical potentials and currents, which are the basis for neural communications. And muscle contraction, same kind of deal. We've already said, we talked about muscles, we talked about action potentials in muscles. They're not that much different from the action potentials that occur in nerve cells. A lot of similarities. The potential itself, the electrical potential, is the difference in concentration of charged particles between one point and another. We're saying the resting cell is polarized. When it is stimulated to essentially send a neural signal, it becomes depolarized. When that happens, you get a difference in concentration of charges, and then that's the basis for electrical current. Okay, so the electrical potential is a difference in the concentration of charged particles. The current is the flow of charged particles from one point to another. And in bodies such as ours, the currents are moved by is essentially the movement of ions. We're talking about the movement of sodium ions and potassium ions through gated channels of the plasma membrane. They are the basis for the electrical current. The gated channels that are open and closed by various stimuli, mainly having to do with the strength of the stimulus. They are responsible for opening these gated channels that then will allow sodium to move in, potassium to move out, vice versa, blah, blah, blah. And that's based on those channels. Those channels are responsible for allowing the cell to turn electrical currents on and off. Okay, so we say the cell is polarized, the living cell, we're talking about a nerve cell, is polarized. The resting membrane potential in the nerve cell is essentially a charge difference between the across the plasma membrane. The resting potential is minus 70 millivolts. RMP, you want to use RMP? That's nice, everybody loves acronyms. Anyway, the resting membrane potential, the difference in the charge is minus 70 millivolts in a resting unstimulated neuron. The negative value means that there are more negative charged particles on the inside of the membrane than on the outside of the membrane. That's reasonable, has to do with distribution or concentration of the ions, specifically the sodium and potassium ions. The resting membrane potential, this is just a rehab. Membrane potential is polarized, positive charge on the outside, negative charge on the inside. Difference in charge, minus 70 millivolts. And that's what this looks like if you have that picture. If you don't have that picture, don't worry about it. Essentially, all I'm saying is here's a neuron. Here's a section of neuron, essentially the nerve fiber, the axon. So here's this little section here. And when it is resting, you have a net negative charge on the inside of the axolemma, and you have a positive charge on the outside of the axolemma or the plasma membrane, and then you stick a little voltmeter on there, and that should register at about minus 70 millivolts in a resting neuron. Okay, so potentials. Local potential, active potentials. Before we get into details of these little things that's here, although you can push a pen, I suppose, except then you won't listen, but that's all right. Local potential, action potential. Okay, local potential is responsible for generating or essentially initiating an action potential. Local potential starts when the dendrites or some kind of receptor stimulates the neuron, and that stimulation is passed through the dendrites. You're going to get changes, essentially depolarization in those dendrites. It then passes through the soma or the body of the nerve cell to the trigger zone. Okay, at the trigger zone, which we said is what? The axon hillock and the initial segment. At the trigger zone, the charge has to get to the point where it has achieved or reached threshold stimulus. What's the threshold stimulus?
The minimum needs
I know. What's the value? 55. Minus 55. Minus 55 millivolts is the threshold stimulus. It needs to reach that because that's necessary for the gated channels to be able to be activated and open. Okay, so as long as it's a minus 55, then the action potential is going to be initiated at that trigger zone. As it moves, you're going to get this essentially sequential wave-like opening and closing of those gated channels that are going to allow sodium to move in, potassium to move out, and then depolarize the nerve. And this moves on the same as the action potential on the muscle cell. It moves down the neuron. So the gates open and they close. The charge of the nerve goes from being polarized to being depolarized. And then the charge or the stimulus moves down the axon in that manner. And then behind it is being repolarized. It's going back to resting. So it's the same as what we discussed when we talked about the action potential in a muscle cell. So local potentials, disturbances in the membrane potential when a neuron is stimulated. The neuron response begins, the dendrite spreads to the soma, travels down the axon, ends at the synaptic knobs. Whether you're talking about a particular junction, like in the neuromuscular junction, or you're talking the synapse, or you're talking neuron to neuron. When a neuron is stimulated, you talk whatever is going to be the stimulus. You're talking chemicals, you're talking light, heat, mechanical disturbance, whatever. Whatever it causes or is responsible for initiating or stimulating that neuron. What that causes is it opens the sodium gates, allows the sodium to rush into the cell. The influx of the sodium ions and neutralizes some of the internal negative charge. the voltage measured across the membrane begins to drift towards zero because you are increasing the positive charge on the inside of the cell, reducing the negative charge. You're going to change that voltage. Depolarization is the case when the membrane voltage shifts to a less negative value. So the sodium diffuses for a short distance. The inside of the plasma membrane produces a current that travels toward the cell's trigger zone. And that short range in voltage change is what's called the local potential. And so the local potential comes first, and then that is what triggers the action potential, which is the stimulus that actually is responsible for some kind of action by the neuron. Are we happy, Lace? Almost happy. I'd ask Taylor, but she's done.
No, I'm not.
Is that an electrotonic?
I'm sorry.
Is that an electrotonic that goes across the cell body?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's the term you use.
And then the salutary thing happens later?
Well, no, the conductions, we're going to get to the conductions. The conductions may be just a straight, continuous conduction, which is the case in unmyelinated nerves, or it might be saltatory if you're talking about myelinated nerves. So you've got two different kinds of flow, but yeah, the flow is initiated at the trigger zone and then it moves. Okay, that's ridiculous, that cartoon. And it's not ridiculous, it's just showing you what the reversal of the charges. Okay, here's the polarized membrane, and then you get a stimulus, and then you start to get the depolarization that occurs and the spread of the depolarization. Okay, action potentials. They're transmitted long distances in one direction. I'm sorry, did I lose you, Ace?
No.
Oh, good. The direction is anterograde. You remember anterograde? Anterograde, it goes from the soma to the synaptic vesicle or the synaptic knob or whatever, or the end of the axon. And that direction is anterograde, away from the soma. It occurs where there's a high enough density of voltage-gated channels essentially at the trigger zone. That has to be at that minus 55. Initiated by local potentials from the dendrites, to or through the soma, and it involves membrane permeability changes due to sequential opening and closing of voltage gated charges. That's what's going on, channels, that's what's going on. Threshold voltage, minus 55 millivolts. So, as the sodium ions move in, it's going to reduce the size of the negative charge. It's going to go from minus 70, which is a resting potential, resting charge, a resting membrane potential. It's going to move to 55 as the sodium influx occurs. When it reaches 55, then that's the voltage that's required to open voltage-gated channels. All right? You agree? Oh, good. How we doing over there, Taylor? All right? Good. Okay. Okay, when the threshold's reached, the neuron fires. It produces an action potential. More and more sodium channels open in the trigger zone. It's a positive feedback cycle. You remember positive feedback? The increase in sodium increases sodium, blah, blah, blah. And as you move down this thing, it's essentially a positive feedback mechanism. It creates essentially the feedback cycle, or increasing sodium concentration, results in a rapid rise in membrane voltage, and it's referred to as a spike. When you take a look at that curve or that graph of a nerve firing, it's a spike. Okay, unlike when we looked at the graph, the myogram for the muscle, where you had the nice little latent period, and then you had the beginning, the rise, the contraction, and you had the relaxation, and this nice rounded curve goes down to relaxation. In a nerve, bam, it fires, and you get this spike that occurs once the potential is reached. When rising memory potential passes zero millivolts, sodium gates are inactivated, begin to close. So essentially, you are going to begin to return back to the resting potential after it passes zero. When all the sodium gates are closed, usually the voltage peaks at plus 35 millivolts. That's the spike. Okay, when it fires, it depolarizes. And on the depolarization side, when a nerve fires, it reaches a positive 35 millivolt charge. Okay, at this point, the membrane's positive on the inside, negative on the outside. The polarity is reversed, and the resting membrane potential depolarization has essentially occurred. By the way, I did get your email, but it was too late to really be of any use. I mean, it wouldn't have helped you if I answered when I finally saw it, so I apologize. I'll try and do better. Anyway, you didn't miss a lot, I don't think. Just getting this neuron structure, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Anyway, so then by the time the voltage peaks, the potassium gates are fully open. They are repelled by the positive charge inside, and they exit the cell. And their outflow begins to repolarize the membrane. And it starts to shift the voltage back to negative numbers. So as the potassium leaves, then the inside charge is going to start to become more negative. Eventually, it'll move back toward the resting membrane potential. Potassium gates stay open longer than the sodium gates do. And what essentially it says is it overshoots the mark. In other words, the gates stay open a little bit too long. It drops the membrane potential maybe 1 or 2 millivolts below the resting membrane potential. And then that's referred to as hyperpolarization or after potential. But then it just returns back, bounces back up to the resting potential. And then the sodium and potassium switch places across the membrane during an action potential. You got two gates. This one here is a chemically gated ion channel. This one here is voltage gated. What we've been talking about are voltage gated. These guys here are at the synaptic knob, where you've got essentially neurotransmitters. So you've got a channel, a sodium channel that's associated with the action potential. It's closed. It requires a receptor on this gate in order for it to open. And the receptors essentially receive neurotransmitters as chemicals which attach to the receptor, and when they attach, neurotransmitter attaches, then the gate's open and you get the exchange of ions. That happens at the junction, at the synapse, or essentially at the synaptic bulb. The voltage-gated channels are the ones we've just been talking about. As the voltage increases, decreases essentially, as the membrane voltage changes, the gap will open those sodium channels, and then the sodium will begin to move into the cell. Are we happy with that? Yeah?
Is that a substrate?
Is what a substrate?
That attaches to that?
No, substrate's only when you're talking about enzymes. What it is a neurotransmitter. Might be an acetylcholine, it may be epinephrine, it may be norepinephrine. There's a receptor site that accommodates whatever type of neurotransmitter you're talking about, and when that neurotransmitter attaches to that receptor site, then that causes a change in shape of the channel, and then it will allow sodium to move in. In that respect, it might be more analogous to an allosteric kind of inhibitor or activator in the transport. Okay, so action potential. There's the curve of a spike of a neuron. Okay, and what it's saying is, okay, here's the neuron. It's nice and happy, resting comfortably, not doing much of anything at minus 70 millivolts. What happens is you begin to generate a local potential. Okay, the local potential is generated as a result of stimulus that comes through the dendrites, through the soma, to the trigger zone. Okay, so local potential begins to move to that area of the trigger zone. The charge begins to drop from minus 70 to minus 55. When it gets to minus 55 at the trigger zone, that's the threshold stimulus. The nerve is going to fire. Okay, all the sodium gates are going to begin to open, and the nerve, essentially the axolemma, is going to become depolarized, and you'll achieve a spike at that. At the spike, anyway, when the sodium gates have started to close, you reach a maximum voltage of plus the positive 35 millivolts. Okay, that's the spike, anyway. Then repolarization occurs. That starts as the sodium channels close and the potassium channels are still open. You're going to start to get a reversal of those charges, so that then it's the negative charge on the inside of the membrane is going to be restored, and you're going to move back toward the resting potential. That's repolarization at this point. It said down here that the potassium channels stay open a little bit too long, so that you actually go below the resting potential by 1 or 2 millivolts, but then it'll just bounce back and come to the resting membrane potential. This area right here, or this change in voltage, is essentially what the action potential voltage is. So you got a local gradient potential that arrives. Threshold voltage is reached right here. The sodium channel is open, influx of sodium ions into the cell. Sodium channels close. Potassium outflux in the cell repolarizes. On this side, the slow potassium channels remain open and the cell hyperpolarizes down here. How we doing over there? Good. The resting membrane potential, or RMP, is restored. Okay, so continuation. Only a thin layer of cytoplasm next to the cell membrane is affected. Very few ions on a relative basis are actually involved in the process, but enough so that you can change the voltages. The action potential is often called a spike, mainly because of the speed associated with it. Characteristics of the action potential versus a local potential. Action potential follows an all or none law. When an action potential is initiated or generated, it goes. Okay, it's all or none. Once you reach the threshold, the nerve will fire, and it will go to completion. So if the threshold is reached, the neuron fires at its maximum voltage. If the threshold is not reached, it doesn't fire. So if you don't get to the minus 55, then the nerve is not going to fire. Once you do, though, bam, then the action potential goes to completion, and the nerve transmission occurs. It says it's non-decremental. It says it doesn't get weaker at distance. So however long that axon is, if you're talking about the sciatic nerve, which is 3 feet long, or whether you're talking about, you know, someone in dinky nerve somewhere else, distance is not a factor. The strength of the stimulus is maintained throughout the entire process, and it's irreversible. Once it starts, it goes to completion. It can't be stopped. Oh, we're doing terrific. I'm liking this. Okay, so all we got? We got a cartoon. I love cartoons.
When the cell membrane is at its resting membrane potential, the activation gates of the voltage-gated sodium ion channels are closed and the inactivation gates are open. Voltage-gated potassium ion channels are closed. Depolarization is initiated by a stimulus which makes the membrane potential more positive, causing the voltage-gated sodium ion channels to start to open. As threshold is reached, many sodium channels open. Sodium ions diffuse across the membrane, causing depolarization. Voltage-gated potassium ion channels also begin to open, but more slowly. Therefore, depolarization occurs because more sodium ions diffuse into the cell than potassium ions diffuse out of it. As the membrane potential approaches maximum depolarization, the inactivation gates of the voltage-gated sodium ion channels begin to close, and the diffusion of sodium ions decreases. The potassium ion channels remain open, and potassium ions continue to diffuse out of the cell. The increased potassium ion permeability lasts slightly longer than the time required to bring the membrane potential back to its resting level. The extra efflux of potassium ions causes the membrane potential to become slightly more negative than the resting value. After the voltage-gated potassium ion channels close, the active transport of sodium and potassium ions reestablishes the resting membrane potential.
Okay, so after everything is said and done, and essentially sodium potassium pumps are activated, and then you restore the concentration of the ions back to where they're supposed to be. Let me see, I figured this out. Why I'm telling you, you can teach an old person new tricks sometimes. Not too often. I did it. I found out by accident. You know, I touched the stupid mouse when I was going through this thing, and it changed. And I said, "That's how you change it. You don't have to shut the whole thing off and go back and then restart it."
Ta-da!
An enlightenment. That's right. It was like an epiphany. Okay, the refractory period is essentially the time, just as it was in the muscle contraction, that the nerve can't be re-stimulated or to fire. So refractory period, you've got an absolute refractory period, a relative refractory period. Absolute refractory period is once you get past threshold and this thing begins to depolarize, it doesn't matter. You can throw the strongest stimulus in the world at it. This thing isn't going to fire again. It's going to go to completion and go back to resting. When you get back down here, though, on the depolarization side, it's referred to as relative refractory period, and very strong stimuli can cause the nerve to fire again before it actually reaches baseline and gets back to it. So refractory period of resistance to stimulation, two phases, absolute refractory period, no stimulus of any strength will trigger an action potential. The membrane is depolarized. Okay, so nothing can cause it to recreate or restart an action potential. Relative refractory period, only especially strong stimulus will trigger a new action potential. The membrane is, again, is hyperpolarized when it gets down to this point. So it's possible on this side of the curve to be able to hit it with a strong stimulus again and get it to essentially start or restart the action potential. Okay, oh, we got another cartoon. All right.
A nerve impulse is an electrical current that travels along dendrites or axons due to ions moving through voltage-gated channels in the neuron's plasma membrane. Voltage-gated channels open and close in response to an electrical voltage, so they are affected by changes in electrical charge around them. When a neuron is at rest, a charge difference is maintained between the inside and outside of the cell. This charge difference is produced and maintained largely by active transport using sodium-potassium pumps. The pumps send sodium ions out of the cell and bring potassium ions in. While other channels allow some flow of potassium ions back out of the cell, the sodium ions cannot easily get back in to replace the lost positive charges. The overall result is that the exterior of the cell has a net positive charge and the interior has a net negative charge. The difference in charge between the interior and exterior of the cell is called the resting membrane potential. A nerve impulse begins when a stimulus disturbs the plasma membrane on a dendrite, causing sodium channels to open. Sodium ions flow into the cell, lessening the charge difference at that location. If the change is enough, it will cause nearby voltage-gated sodium channels to open. This allows so many sodium ions to flood into the cell at that location that the membrane there is depolarized, with the local region inside the cell having a net positive charge and the outside of the cell having a net negative charge. This affects neighboring voltage-gated sodium channels, which then open, moving the depolarization along the membrane. This moving depolarization is called an action potential. Changes occur behind the action potential to restore the resting membrane potential. The voltage-gated sodium channels close and voltage-gated potassium channels open. This allows a rapid flow of potassium ions out of the cell, repolarizing the membrane so that the inside is again negative and the outside positive. This is followed by use of sodium-potassium pumps to fully restore the resting membrane potential and to reestablish proper concentrations of sodium and potassium ions inside and outside the cell.
Okay, so that's the basis for the transmission of a nerve impulse. This is talking about different types of fibers and how the communication takes place and how the action potentials actually move. This is signal conduction in an unmyelinated fiber. It says that for communication to occur, nerve signal must travel to the end of the axon. In unmyelinated fiber, as a voltage-regulated ion gates along the entire length, the action potential from the trigger zone causes sodium to enter the axon, diffuse into adjacent regions beneath the membrane. Depolarization excites voltage-gated regulated gates immediately distal. Essentially, the sodium-potassium gates open and close, producing new action potential. By repetition, the membrane distal to that is excited. So essentially you have a chain reaction, or essentially a wave. You get this thing moving down. And in the case of an unmyelinated nerve, it's just a continuous transmission of the action potential along the axon. You happy with that yet? Good. Okay, signal conductions in unmyelinated fibers, continuous conduction, essentially. This is similar to what that cartoon was showing. This is saying here's an action potential in progress, here's a refractory period, refractory membrane, and an excited membrane. So essentially what this is saying is that this is this little block here, okay, and the membrane potential is going to move as a result of the change in the charges. So the influx of the sodium, the loss of the potassium, you get the depolarization, and this moves down this axon. Essentially, that's what it's saying. Behind it, you get a restoration of the original charge configuration so that then this thing goes back to resting potential as a result of the action of sodium potassium pumps, which reestablish the electrical configuration, restore negative charge on the inside, positive on the outside, and a resting membrane potential of minus 70 millivolts. So that's continuous conduction. Saltatory conduction is what occurs in myelinated fibers. You remember myelinated fibers? Myelinated fibers have got Schwann cells that essentially form the myelin that covers the axons in myelinated nerves. So you've got the myelinated region, which is referred to as an inner node, and then between those inner nodes, you've got the nodes of Grandier, which do not have the covering as far as the Schwann cell is concerned. And the movement in myelinated fibers sort of leapfrogs. Okay, that's probably the best way to say it. The reason is the sodium influx at the nodes generates action potential. To begin with, it's slow, but the sodium diffuses on the inside of the axolemma next to the nodes are not decremental. Excitation or voltage-regulated gates will generate the next action potential. So essentially, it's moving from here to here to here, almost like a leapfrog, because there's faster transmission at the nodes than there is at the inner nodes. The most voltage-gated channels are located at the inner nodes. The fast sodium diffusion occurs between nodes. And saltatory conduction, the nerve signal seems to jump from node to node, sort of like leapfrogging. So it's going from here to here to here to here. And it results in essentially a faster transmission of the impulse that occurs in an unmyelinated nerve. Okay, so this is showing this schematic, okay? So here, you target same zones, excitable membrane, essentially resting potential, refractory membrane after the transmission has taken place, and here's the action potential. So I'm saying, take this guy here, action potential created here, then it jumps to this node, then it jumps to this node, and it'll jump to the next node. In the meantime, you've got the reestablishment of the resting membrane potential behind it. So the charge moves like this, from here to here to here. And this is much faster conduction than in an unmyelinated fiber. Are we happy with that? Yeah, you're happy? Oh, you might want to bring that to you. Oh, how nice.
Looks
used to bring a big one.
I have.
Ah, okay. Okay, neural coding. Neural coding says that there's some semblance of recognition as far as the kinds of stimulus, the strengths of stimulus, that results in some kind of a discernment of the signals that are being transmitted. It says the language of nerve impulses making sense of messages. There's qualitative information. We won't really talk about this in detail until we get to the next unit. Qualitative information says that depends on which neurons are firing. Receptors, certain receptors recognize particular stimulus types, so they can discern differences between which nerves are actually sending the stimulus. And that's referred to as qualitative information. The receptors recognize particular stimulus types. Quantitative information is related to the intensity of the stimulus, how strong the stimulus is. The neurons have different thresholds of excitation. The more strongly a neuron is stimulated, the more frequently that it fires. I lost my place. Oh, got it. We'll get there. Oh, there I go. This thing here, I don't know whether you have this or not. It was in the 5th edition. Is it in the 6th edition?
Probably.
It is or it isn't? It is. Okay. Neurocoding says, okay, each of these spikes is an action potential. And what it's showing is a demonstration of how the strength of the stimulus is going to change the action potentials that occur in a particular neuron. These grams, they refer to weights that are hung onto a gastrocnemius muscle. Okay, and in this case, you have 2 gram weight. The stimulus, the strength of the stimulus that's necessary to move that 2 gram weight requires this numbers of action potentials. You increase the weight, you're increasing the strength of the stimulus. You're increasing the numbers of action potentials that, as far as activating more and more muscle to deal with that increasing mass of that weight. You double it, you have 10 grams, you probably double the number of action potentials, which would result in more recruitment of muscle fibers, more strength, blah, blah, blah. And then this one here, you doubled it again, and so you've got almost continuous firing of nerves that are being stimulating, in this case, the muscle to contract to the extent necessary to deal with this 20-gram weight. Okay. So, synapses. We all know what synapses are. Synapses pretty much mediate the action potential and transfer it from one neuron to the next cell. Whether it's another neuron or whether it's another type of cell. The synapse is a junction that mediates action potential transfer from one neuron to the next, or from one neuron to the next cell or the next neuron. It triggers release of neurotransmitter. It stimulates a new wave of electrical activity in the next cell across the synapse. That might be a muscle cell, it might be another nerve cell. Right now we're talking about nerves, so this unit likes nerves. Neuron names, there's presynaptic and postsynaptic. Presynaptic neuron, the first neuron in the signal path is presynaptic neuron. It releases a neurotransmitter. So in this presynaptic neuron, it's going to pick up a stimulus. It's going to pick up a stimulus through its dendrites. It's going to transmit that signal by way of action potential to the synaptic knob at the end of its axon, and at that point is going to release neurotransmitters. The neurotransmitters then are going to serve to activate the next neuron, the next cell, which is the postsynaptic neuron. And then it will continue or propagate that action potential. So the presynaptic neuron releases a neurotransmitter. Second neuron, postsynaptic, responds to the neurotransmitter. It will have the receptors that are going to be activated as a result of neurotransmitters binding to those receptor sites. They will open gates, only these are chemically gated proteins, chemically gated proteins, and they will continue or initiate the local potential to the next cell, and that will then continue that transmission and end up with another action potential. How are we doing over there, Tay? All right?
Yep.
Good shape. Okay. That's good. Why do you even ask back there? Look at that. How rude of me. Okay, so the structure of chemical synapse, you know this. You know this from what we talked about with muscles. The synaptic knob, the presynaptic neuron contains synaptic vesicles. The synaptic vesicles contain neurotransmitters. It says that in the case of the nerves anyway, a lot of these vesicles are docked on the release sites of the plasma membrane. They're ready to release neurotransmitter on demand as opposed to just sort of floating around in the middle of the knob. Although it says there is a reserve pool of synaptic vesicles located further away from the membrane. The postsynaptic neuron membrane contains proteins that function as receptors and ligand-regulated ion gates. So, neurotransmitter attaches to the receptor and then it activates those ion gates. Okay, here's the structure of a chemical synapse. Okay, so here's the end of the axon. Here's the axon or synaptic knob or axonic bulb, whatever you want to say. Here's all these nice synaptic vesicles that are inside that contain neurotransmitter. Vesicles are stimulated, not unlike the in the case we were talking about with the muscles. Calcium ions that are on the outside of this thing, there's greater permeability. When the stimulus comes, it increases the permeability of calcium ions. Calcium ions move in, and they are responsible for activating or exciting or stimulating these synaptic vesicles to release their content of their neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters then flow across the synaptic cleft, neurosynaptic cleft, the space between the bulb and the next cell. Here's the receptors. The neurotransmitter binds to the receptors, and then it will initiate the next, essentially the next action potential, or local potential action potential. So presynaptic neurons, synaptic vesicles, blah, 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 neurotransmitter, postsynaptic chemical gated channels. I think this is the last part.
Action potentials arriving at the presynaptic terminal cause voltage-gated calcium ion channels to open. Calcium ions diffuse into the cell and cause synaptic vesicles to release acetylcholine, a neurotransmitter molecule. Acetylcholine molecules diffuse from the presynaptic terminal across the synaptic cleft and bind to their receptor sites on the ligand-gated sodium ion channels. This causes the ligand-gated sodium ion channels to open and sodium ions diffuse into the cell, making the membrane potential more positive. If the membrane potential reaches threshold level an action potential will be produced.
That's what we said.
Why did it show the potassium?
Huh?
Why did it show the potassium?
I don't know, maybe it doesn't like it. I don't know, but potassium's there. Maybe it didn't have enough room in this cartoon. I don't know. But the potassium's there. Okay, you see the charges right here. This one here is showing you the exchanges. Okay, sodium in, potassium out. Here's potassium. Okay, the cartoon was fluorized. That's all I can say. The cartoon was fluorized. Okay, we'll complain. Anyway, here's a presynaptic neuron. Here's a postsynaptic neuron. Here, here's the synaptic vesicles. Calcium in stimulates the release of neurotransmitter, neurotransmitter out. The receptor proteins on the membrane, plasma membrane of the postsynaptic neuron, neurotransmitters attached, gates open, sodium in, potassium out. You change the charge, you go from the resting charge back to having the depolarization. And then that will essentially initiate the action potential. And if you're talking about a neuron, then that's got to go from the dendrites to the soma, to the trigger zone, and then the next neuron will fire. Are we happy? Cholinergic synapses says that's a synapse where acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter. There's other types. Mutex has got other types. I think I don't like any of it, though. I think I don't like it, but I think I'm done. I think what we covered on 12 is what we covered on 12.
That's it. Forget about all the adrenergic.
You can learn all you want of that right now.
No,
okay.
Thank you.
Live it up. Okay.
Huh?
Nursing.
Nursing?
Are you a nurse?
Well, yeah and no. I just
heard
this.
You're going
to
need it? Yeah. After. We could spend, there's 100 neurotransmitters. We could spend another week talking about neurotransmitters if you want. I'm not done, though. I'm just done with chapter.
I was just putting this away for a second. I saw a recording right here.
Oh, here's the
recording.
Yeah,
yeah.
Good. I saw the recording.
Yeah. No, we're
all
not.
All circuits are still open.
We're not. Now we're going to talk about the brain. We're talking about the brain for a while today. We'll finish talking about the brain again on Monday. And then on Wednesday, we'll see what you know about the brain and the nervous system.
Oh, really? I thought it was Thursday.
Huh?
I didn't realize it was Wednesday.
So describing...
Well, Thursday would be interesting.
Describing an action potential would
make a great essay. Sure, there's lots of good essay questions in this group. Okay, so central nervous system, we're talking about, at least in this unit, we're talking about the brain. We won't spend time with the spinal cord until we get to the next unit. So we're going to talk primarily about the brain, mention the spinal cord with respect to the meninges, but that's about it. As far as central nervous system overview, the regions of the brain, we talk primarily about the anatomy of the brain, the physical structures. Different areas, different zones, different parts, blah, 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 whatever. And then we'll talk some about the specific functions of the different parts of the brain. And I think we'll go as far as we go. Anyway. Okay, so region of the brain, four major regions. You're talking about the cerebrum and the diencephalum, brain stem, and cerebellum. But looking at this guy, and we'll look at him off and on. As far as landmarks are concerned, you're talking rostral, caudal, anterior, posterior. So here's the back of the brain or the tail end. Here's the nose end of the brain or the front end of the brain. As far as the features are concerned, we'll come to know and love. The cerebrum is the major characteristic as far as the brain is concerned. The cerebellum, next major as far as size is concerned. And we got the midbrain and brain stem, and spinal cord is attached. The cerebrum constitutes about 83% of the brain by volume. You've got a right, divided into hemispheres. You've got cerebral hemispheres. You've got a right and a left cerebral hemisphere. So look at it, cool. One side, next side, right side, left side. Diencephalon, which is the central brain, is surrounded by the cerebrum. So the cerebrum almost covers, essentially it does, it covers the diencephalon, which is the next major region as far as the brain is concerned, surrounded by the cerebrum. The brain stem is the midbrain and the pons and the medulla oblongata. And then the cerebellum is located in inferior posterior position, essentially in that caudal, cranial caudal region as far as the skull is concerned. Oh, we're going to be in good shape. I was worried, but I'm not worried anymore. Are you happy, Joe?
Yes.
Good. Okay, the cerebrum. The cerebrum, characteristics which are major features, longitudinal fissure, okay, which is essentially a deep groove that separates the cerebral hemispheres, the right hemisphere, left hemisphere, and then longitudinal fissure exists, or essentially is a deep groove between them. These characteristics are what gives this spaghetti-looking appearance to the brain or whatever. The gyri are the thick folds, essentially these wormy-looking things are the gyri, and then the sulci are the shallow grooves or the grooves that exist between those thick folds. Corpus callosum, you can't see it unless you cut the brain in half and take a look on the inside, but corpus callosum is a major characteristic. It's thick bundles of myelinated nerves at the bottom of the longitudinal fissure. Essentially, they form tracts, major tracts. The corpus callosum is what connects the hemispheres of the brain. Crossed over. Myelinated fibers. White matter, whatever. Okay, cerebellum sitting back here, posterior cranial fossa. Sitting toward the back of the, it's also marked by the gyri in the sulci. It has fissures associated with the cerebellum. By volume, cerebellum is about 10% of the brain, but it has about 50% of the neurons. So there's more activity as far as that area is concerned than there is in the rest of the brain. Anyway, over 50% of neurons, brain neurons exist in the cerebellum. Really fast today.
I know.
Whoa. Okay, the brain stem says that's what remains of the brain if you take the cerebrum and cerebellum and pull them off. Okay, so if you remove the cerebrum and cerebellum, what's left underneath is the brain stem, and the major components of the brain stem are the diencephalon. We'll talk about it as far as its functions are concerned, structure, the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata. Anything else in there that's new? No, no, no. Okay. So, gray and white matter. The difference between gray and white matter has to be mainly whether or not you're talking about myelinated or unmyelinated nerves. The gray matter forms the cortex of the brain and also of the spinal cord, for that matter. Gray matter are neuron cell bodies, or somas, the dendrites, unmyelinated axons, glial cells, blah, 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 the blood vessels associated with it. It gets its name because of its characteristic color. It's got a dull white color due to very little myelin associated with those neurons. So they're mainly unmyelinated. Also a lot of functionality going on with respect to, you know, and you say, how much gray matter have you got? Well, lots of the functionality associated with the gray matter. The white matter are mainly tracts which have to do with communication between different areas of the nervous system. The gray matter forms a surface layer in the cortex over the cerebrum and the cerebellum. We'll have a little image up there, and essentially you see the gray matter essentially is around the outside portion, or it forms the cortex of those structures. They also form the deep nuclei. What are the deep nuclei? What are the nuclei? What are the nuclei?
They're bundles.
Bundles? Of?
Nerves.
No. Bundles of?
Somas.
Look at that. Bundles of somas. Very good. Okay, so the nuclei deep within the brain, anyway, are also gray matter. We'll take a look at them and we'll talk about their functionality because it's significant. The white matter are bundles of myelinated axons that serve as tracts. Essentially, communication between different parts of the brain or different structures or different parts of the nervous system. They connect one part of the central nervous system to another. Oh, you're smiling. Good. Okay, so here's a cadaver brain. Essentially, here's the rostrum or anterior side, here's the caudal or posterior part. Essentially, all of this outside here is gray matter, and it serves as the cortex for the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and it also is the nervous tissue associated with the deep nuclei. Here's a caudate nuclei right here. You've got a couple more that are cited in here. Let's see. I don't think so. But anyway, this caudate nuclei is gray matter. Okay, other structures in here, as long as we've got it up here. Here's the longitudinal fissure. Here's the corpus callosum. There's an anterior part of it. Here's a posterior part of it, but essentially it runs the whole way around. When you cut this thing through, you see the way the corpus callosum looks. But essentially, those are the white matter tracts. The white matter is all of this inside region, which are primarily connections between different parts of the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord. The ventricles, we'll talk about the ventricles. The ventricles are spaces that essentially contain cerebral spinal fluid. They move cerebral spinal fluid around the central nervous system. They are responsible for making sure that the nervous tissue, the brain, and the spinal cord are bathed in cerebral spinal fluid, which is important as far as the functionality is concerned. Lateral sulcus, insula, we'll talk about that. The occipital lobe naturally in the back where the occipital part of the skull exists. Okay, so here's the occipital lobes. What else? Thalamus is in this particular region. Choroid plexus, we're going to talk about it. It has a role in the cerebral spinal fluid production in the ventricles. I think that's probably about good for that. Okay, so here's a cross section. And essentially what you see here that you couldn't see on the other, you see the corpus callosum. It is a major structure on the inside. White matter are primarily the major tracts that connect the right and the left cerebral hemispheres. Okay, so it's got lots and lots of myelinated neurons that serve as connections between both sides of the brain. The cingulate gyrus, which sort of around the outside of that corpus callosum, it's part of the limbic system, and we're going to talk about the limbic system in a little bit, emotions and the like. The choroid plexus, we already said, are essentially groups or masses of capillaries which are responsible for production of the cerebral spinal fluid in the ventricles. You've got thalamus, you've got hypothalamus. This region here is midbrain, pons. What else is in here? You've got the ventricles. We'll look at the ventricles again. the pineal gland. Pineal gland sits way up in here. Pineal gland is thought to have something to do with circadian rhythm, as far as the night-day temporal kind of a structure. Otherwise, nobody knows for sure what the pineal gland is doing. Commissure, when it talks about commissure, you're talking about the same kind of thing. You're talking about tracts. Commissures are nerve tracts between different parts of the brain or different parts of the nervous system. And you got the cerebellum sitting back here where it's arborvitae. Looks like trees anyway. I took a little further on that. That's good. Okay, so here's a prettier picture rather than the cadaver. As far as the structures are concerned, at least a couple more things get picked up. So here's the central sulcus, okay, and you've got the different lobes that are indicated, frontal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe, temporal lobe. The corpus callosum, again, this white matter tract between the lobes and between the cerebral hemispheres. Thalamus is sitting back here. Hypothalamus is sitting around the outside of it. Optic chiasma wasn't indicated on the last one. Optic chiasma is where the optic nerves come in, essentially cross over, and are responsible for the type, the way that the vision, at least where the way that visual sensation is picked up. Mammillary bodies also have a function in terms of transmission of different types of impulses. We'll talk about pituitary gland. Pituitary gland is part of the endocrine system, produces all the master hormones, all the trophic hormones, which control all, pretty much the rest of the endocrine system is controlled by the hormones that are released in the pituitary gland. It's connected to the hypothalamus by a stalk, which is called the infundibulum, terrific little stalk. Actually, it serves as a track for moving the stuff. What else is in there? Oh, as far as those regions of the diencephalon are concerned, you've got a region here that's referred to as the epithalamus, which includes the pineal gland and this habenula. Then you've got the thalamus, and then you've got the hypothalamus. So those two regions are sort of work in concert. Yeah, that's good. We're doing all right. Okay, so let's talk about coverings. Meninges. You got three connective tissues that are responsible for covering the, or providing protective tissue membranes, protective membranes between the central nervous system and the bone. Talking about either the skull, or you're talking about the vertebral column. So these connective tissue serve as protectors for the sensitive nervous tissue which lies beneath. You've got three of them. You've got an outer dura mater, you've got an inner arachnoid mater, and you've got an inner pia mater. Dura mater is a very thick, tough outer covering. Okay, it's in the cranium or in the cranial area. There's two layers to it. One is referred to as the periosteal layer, and this thing says it's equivalent to the periosteum. It sort of is. When you take a look at a cadaver, and hopefully we'll get to do that if I can ever talk to somebody in the office about it, if the skull cap has been removed, usually this periosteal layer of the dura mater is still attached, or you can see it. Attached to the skull or the bone. So there's a connectivity between the periosteum of the bone and the periosteal layer of the dura mater. The inner layer is referred to as the meningeal layer of the dura mater. It separates the periosteal layer in fissures that form sort of a dural type of a septa. Oops, I'm sorry. So you got two layers of dura mater. That doesn't continue into the spinal cord. Only the arachnoid mater and the pia mater continue into the spinal cord. The arachnoid mater is the middle layer. It lies between the subdural space. When we get the diagram up here, you'll see the subdural space and the subarachnoid space. So between the subdural space, which is the space just beneath the dura mater, there's a space, and it's referred to as the subdural space. Okay. Then you've got the arachnoid mater, okay, that layer of connective tissue, and then beneath it, you've got another space, and the space beneath the arachnoid mater is the subarachnoid space. Subarachnoid space is where pretty much most of the blood vessels and the cerebral spinal fluid reside. Also contains the arachnoid villi that transfer blood into the sinuses and return it to the circulatory system. So the movement of the cerebral spinal fluid and essentially the movement to and out of the circulatory system are the responsibility, or this arachnoid villi has a role in accomplishing that. And the last one is the pia mater, or the soft mother. The soft mother is a very thin membrane that essentially is adhered to the brain. Okay, it essentially follows the line of the brain. I don't know whether you were able to peel any of that off of your little sheep brain or not, but that pia mater essentially is almost attached to the brain itself. And it follows that contour as far as the brain is concerned. Okay, arachnoid mater and pia mater are similar to those in the spinal cord. So essentially, those two meninges continue on into the spinal cord. Dura mater is reserved to the skull or the cranium. This diagram, hopefully you've got something like that, that just takes a piece of the brain and the skull and wedges it out of there. Here's the skull, there's a flat bone, blah, 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 sandwich, compact bone, spongy bone, compact bone. Beneath it, you've got the dura mater. The dura mater, with the periosteal layer, which is closest to the bone, and then the inner layer, which is the meningeal layer, which is closest to the brain. They actually continue through. You've got this, essentially this longitudinal fissure, essentially this particular portion, meningeal layer, travels through the longitudinal fissure. You've got this sagittal sinus, which is has a lot to do with the blood that's associated with the circulatory system. So beneath that meningeal layer, you have the subdural space. Subdural space is the space that exists between the meningeal layer of the dura mater and the arachnoid mater itself. The space that's there is the subdural space. Then you've got the connective tissue, essentially the arachnoid mater, and beneath it, you've got all these cilia, all these villi, lots of blood vessels. This is where most all of the circulation associated with the brain, you have major blood vessels in that subarachnoid space. So beneath the membrane itself, you've got the subarachnoid space with all of these nice villi that are associated with it. Arachnoid villus, these are specialized structures here and here, which have to do with the movement and reabsorption of cerebral spinal fluid. Cerebral spinal fluid actually flows in the subarachnoid space. So it's produced, it's released, and the cerebral spinal fluid is in the subarachnoid space in the brain region as well as the spinal cord region. And then you've got that nice little thin layer, that pia mater, that's actually adhered to the brain itself. Okay, meningitis, that's pathology of the meninges, inflammation of the meninges, serious diseases in infancy and kids anyway. That's not quite as hazardous in adults, but it can be. In younger kids, it's a kind of detrimental as far as the prognosis. Either bacterial or viral meningitis, if positive bacteria is probably bacterial meningitis is more prevalent. It's an invasion of the central nervous system, usually by way of the nose or throat. The pia mater and arachnoid mater are the most affected areas. Specifically, bacterial meningitis causes swelling of the brain, enlarging ventricles, hemorrhaging, and then symptomology is the high fevers and the stiff necks and the drowsiness, intense headaches, blah, blah, blah. Coma, possible if it's prolonged as far as the meningitis is concerned, and then death is possible. Diagnose meningitis by doing a lumbar puncture, or especially a spinal tap, and in the lumbar region of the spinal, of the vertebral column, usually insert a needle there into the subarachnoid space, and then withdraw spinal fluid from that space. You don't take very much of it, maybe about 10 cc's most, because there isn't a ton of spinal fluid. You take too much and the person ends up with a headache for weeks and weeks and weeks. So you want to be careful how much spinal fluid is removed. What you're looking for as far as that's concerned, the examination of spinal fluid, you're looking for bacteria or cloudiness. Spinal fluid should be nice, crystal clear, shouldn't have any cloudiness associated with it at all. Okay, the ventricles are associated with cerebral spinal fluid, the movement of cerebral spinal fluid. You're talking about four ventricles. Ventricles are spaces within the brain where the spinal fluid is produced and where it is circulated, where it moves throughout the brain and eventually into the spinal cord. You've got two lateral ventricles. So you got one, two, you got four. You have four ventricles. You have two lateral ventricles. Then you have the third ventricle. So I guess they're saying one of the lateral ventricles is number one, the other one is number two. Then the third ventricle exists. So you've got two lateral ventricles. You've got a third ventricle that exists right here. And then you've got a fourth ventricle that exists back here. Those are the spaces where cerebral spinal fluid is actually produced. You've got connections that exist between these. Between the lateral ventricles, you have this interventricular foramen, which serves as a duct that moves cerebral spinal fluid from those ventricles along to the third ventricle. So you've got, here's the lateral ventricles right and left. Here's the interventricular foramen, or foramen. So the spinal movement fluid moves through there, moves to the third ventricle. Third ventricle is in the midbrain region, okay? Cerebral spinal fluid is produced there, or it adds to the content. Then it moves through this cerebral aqueduct, okay? So cerebral aqueduct, spinal fluid moves down into the fourth ventricle. Fourth ventricle, you have more cerebral spinal fluid produced in the chorionic plexus, and then that's added to the volume. Okay, and then it leaves the fourth ventricle by way of apertures. There's two lateral apertures, one medium aperture, and then it's continuous with the central canal and the spinal cord, and so the spinal fluid moves down the central canal and the spinal cord. Here's the lateral apertures, here's the medium aperture. That's a cadaver brain. Not much there to look at. I don't even mean the plexus. Here's the plexus. The plexus are the capillaries where the spinal fluid is produced. You got four internal chambers within the brain. Two lateral ventricles, one in each of the cerebral hemispheres, and then you have that intervertebral foramen, a tiny pore that connects to the third ventricle. The third ventricle is a single narrow medial space beneath the corpus callosum. Cerebral aqueduct runs through the midbrain, connects the third to the fourth ventricle. Fourth ventricle is a little triangular chamber between the pons and the cerebellum, and it connects to the central canal that runs down to the spinal cord. Choroid plexus are significant. They are a spongy mass of blood capillaries that are on the floor of each of those ventricles. Between the choroid plexus and the ependyma is essentially the neuroglial cells, the ependymal neuroglial cells that line the ventricles, cover the choroid plexus, produce the spinal fluid. Remember we talked about glial cells. One of the types of glial cells are the ependymal cells. And those are what line these ventricles, produce the cerebral spinal fluid. They have cilia that are involved in moving the spinal fluid. That's probably where we have to stop.
Does a lot of the cerebral spinal fluid drain down by gravity? A lot of it?
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. Oh, sure. There's movement. Movement of the spinal fluid is a combination of the cilia movement, even the heart movement of the heart, vibrations, whatever. So it's a passive process. It's not, it's not what it's called. You need the last one?
Yeah.
Which one was that? That was this guy here?
Yeah.